Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Most Notorious Podcast, the 1959 Kansas Clutter Murders, made famous by Truman Capote and his classic and groundbreaking nonfiction novel, In Cold Blood.
We don't know who that third person was, but in Hickok's letters, he mentions that they were going to meet up after the murders with someone named Roberts. Hickok writes that as they were murdering the Clutters, they had an hour to meet this Roberts. They didn't want to miss that because $5,000 is a lot of money. And that's what the point of the meeting was to collect $5,000, the other half of a prepayment of $5,000 for the job. That's what led me to believe this wasn't a simple robbery, but actually a murder for hire.
Welcome all to another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I can't believe I haven't done an episode about today's subject before. I guess, as usual, it's all about waiting for the right guest at the right time, and I have him. But before we get to this, I want to say a few words about Patreon. I've been having a lot of fun at patreon.com/mostnotorious over the last few weeks. Every Monday, I have been offering a new episode of Aghast at the Past. You might remember the trial episode I released in January right here on Most Notorious. The premise is simple. It is a This Day in True Crime History show, and I have a great time making and releasing it. Become a patron to gain access to this and to be part of our exclusive Most Notorious community. And it helps to keep the show going. Also, today I've got some Patreon NewsHound tier shoutouts that I am excited to attend to. Julia, Kim, Maggie, Bobby, Michael, Diane, Stacy, and Claire. You guys rock. Thank you so much for helping keep the Most Notorious Podcast in operation. You are supremely appreciated by me. Let's get to the show. So great to have as my guest today, Gary McAvoy. He is the owner of Vintage Memorabilia, where he deals in first edition books, vintage letters, and manuscripts. He is also a lifelong writer, authoring a number of books. The one he's here to talk about today is called And Every Word Is True. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Eric. Good to be here.
So tell us the fascinating story about how you came to be involved in all of this journey that led you to writing this book.
Well, as you say, I have been a collector, dealer of historical manuscripts, books, letters, for some 30, 35 years now. Most of my collection is presidential material, heads of state, some historical photographs, certain first edition books, as you mentioned. I've had no particular focus on or interest in crime, true crime or otherwise. A memorabilia genre known as murderabilia. It's just never interested me in particular. But in March of 2012, a fellow named Ron Nye approached me, and he told me about his dad, and I read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood many, many years before. And he told me who his dad was, and I'd never heard of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, but I figured somebody had to lead the investigation of the Clutter murders, and that he had materials, his dad's materials from that case, and that he'd like to sell them. Now, Ron had medical issues he had to deal with his wife at the time, ex-wife he was taking care of. And so he wouldn't have wanted to sell these materials were it not for medical, needing to meet medical expenses. So he packaged up and sent me the contents of his dad's archive. And when it arrived here, I opened it up and was surprised to find the official Kansas Bureau of Investigation reports, coroner's reports, crime scene photographs, fingerprint cards for Perry Smith and Richard Hickok, the two killers, and what I thought were the principal pieces in the collection, two spiral-bound reporter's notebooks containing Harold Nye's personal observations during the investigation, which he led, by the way, not Alvin Dewey. Harold Nye was the lead investigator in the field for the Clutter case. Anyway, this was all some 200 documents that had been sitting in Nye's attic for, oh, I don't know, 40 years or so. Ron's mother, in fact, when she was moving homes after Harold, her husband, had died, Ron was moving her into a smaller home. So she had decided to get rid of Harold's files, which had been in the attic, boxes of them. And had them shredded right before the move, except for one box, which Ron found when he was visiting his mom the next day. Ron found this box, this banker's box, sitting in the trash bin, and he peeked inside it and found first edition signed copy of In Cold Blood and one of Capote's selected memoirs, selected letters, rather, two books that were signed by Capote, along with a brown folder containing all his dad's investigative material. And so he just pulled it out of the trash, thinking it shouldn't be there, and put it in his van. And one thing led to another. He called me, and after some discussion, he and I determined that an auction of all this material would be the best way to sell it. And Ron preferred that it be one buyer because he felt that holding the historical significance together of all pieces would be the best way to keep them together. In the process of preparing for the auction, I took photograph scans of every item, worked up a presentation as we typically do in the auction world. And then as I began the marketing of it, I issued a press release and did other wide marketing. And this reached newspapers and websites around the world. We got a tremendous amount of interest. About, well, let's see, I'd say 3 weeks after the press release went out, Ron got a personal call from the director of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation asking to meet about the items. When they did meet, this was in Topeka, Kansas. Ron lived in Oklahoma at the time and offered to drive up and meet the director at his office. The director demanded that he turn everything over to the KBI as being their property, state property. Ron took a different position, saying that these were his dad's personal materials, and he declined the director's demand. Well, a few weeks later, here I am in Seattle, just doing my job on the auction, and I'm summoned by the Washington State Attorney General to appear in their offices here in Seattle at the request of the Kansas Attorney General and a meeting to review all the Nye's archive. When my attorney and I got there, there were 13 people in the room, 13, that and another 7 were on the telephone in Topeka, Kansas, at the other end. And over the next 4 hours, the assistant attorney general for Seattle described every piece of paper in specific detail, and it was a tremendous waste of time. But it was all done at the request of the Kansas AG because they thought that I might have things that I didn't tell them about. I had sent them a full copy on CD of everything that was in the archive. And it was only a couple weeks after that that the Attorney General surprisingly instigated a lawsuit prohibiting sale or disclosure of the documents in any form. And we decided to take the case on, defending ourselves on First Amendment issues, because we believe the materials contained items of public interest. After 4 years in court, the judge ruled in our favor, even fining the Kansas Attorney General some $4,000 for false allegations that cost us a great deal to defend against. So in the end, we were able to do what we wanted with Harold Nye's archive. But at that point, we were pretty thrashed after that, Eric. It was a 4-year slog through court, and at the end, we just decided it would be best to donate Harold Nye's materials to the New York Public Library, which is the repository for Truman Capote's estate files and his notes about the Clutter case. And we figured that writing a book about this whole bizarre experience was the natural next step for us, revealing not only what was in the investigation files, but that differed from what Capote had written, but how aggressively the state of Kansas fought to prevent its publication and the suppression of that materials.
Interesting. And part of the collection included some pretty graphic photographs, too.
Oh, yeah. Those I had worked real hard to keep those from reaching the public. I discovered a cult-like fascination with that kind of photograph. And there were a lot of people specifically looking for murder photos of the clutter crimes. I did not want to be responsible for that. When I presented them on the website, they were all the size of postage stamps, only to show the potential bidders that the photos did exist, but it wasn't enough for you to see the gruesome nature of each one of them. And in fact, we returned the photos to the Kansas Attorney General. To the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. We returned all of the originals to them. Did not want to have anything to do with them.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, so I'm guessing most of my listeners are familiar with this case, have read In Cold Blood, or seen the film Capote. But if you wouldn't mind, refresh our memories on the Clutter case. Could you give us a summary? Who were the Clutters? What happened in the early morning hours of November 15th, 1959?
I'd be happy to. Herb Clutter himself was quite a prominent political activist in the agricultural community, not just in Kansas, but nationally. President Dwight Eisenhower personally asked him to serve as the first director of the Farm Credit Board. And Clutter was prominent in many federal posts as well as that. It made him a very important man, and He was extremely engaged in the community, his local community as well, on the board of the local church, the Lutheran church, I believe, and or Methodist. Completely engaged with this community and in federal circles. He had built a fine home that his family had moved into in 1949 in a village outside Garden City, Kansas, called Holcomb. He had a wife and four children, two of whom still lived at home. Nancy, she was 16, and Kenyon, his son, was 15. Now, Mrs. Clutter was known to have had some mental health issues, probably what today we'd call severe depression. So she had a housekeeper in several days a week to care for the house and family. And Nancy, her daughter, took care of meals and did other things that her mother wasn't able to do, being pretty much a shut-in. There's been a lot of controversy about this topic. The rest of the Clutter family, the surviving Clutter family, claims that their mother had no health issues at all, but there are way too many reports from the community that was, in fact, the case. Just after midnight on November 14th, 1959, which would now put us into the November 15th, two men, Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, had entered the house through an open door off the kitchen, intending to rob Clutter's safe, which purportedly contained $10,000 in cash. They woke up the family, tied them up in the upstairs bathroom. But after searching the house thoroughly, they found no safe. In fact, they only found about $40 in cash in all and a couple silver dollars in Nancy's room, some money in Mrs. Clutter's purse, a few dollars in Mr. Clutter's wallet. But still, for whatever reasons, they slaughtered the entire family before they left with four shotgun blasts to the head of each person in a senseless massacre. So that's what I know about the Clutter family.
And interestingly, they didn't take her diamond ring either.
That's right. They left the diamond ring on her hand. There were a few other things in the house. They did take a pair of binoculars, a radio that belonged to Kenyon, but not much that had any particular value.
So besides reading your book, I didn't reread In Cold Blood for this, but I did watch the movie Capote just last night. As you mention in your book, Al Dewey is the law enforcement protagonist character in both stories. But Harold Nye is definitely the hero in your telling of the story, and rightly so. Would you give us a bit of Harold Nye's background and tell us how he got into law enforcement to begin with?
Of course, yeah. Harold was a consummate law enforcement professional. He began his career in his late 20s, effectively as a patrolman for the Garden City Police Department. And then sometime later moved over to the larger Hutchinson, Kansas Police Department. And it was there he caught the attention of the director of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, who offered him a role as a special agent. And I was brought in with three or four other special agents at the same time. And he stayed there for some 20 years until his retirement. And I always told his son and others who would listen to him that he had far more interesting cases other than the Clutter murders. And he never really understood the fascination with that case, apart from, obviously, Capote's famous treatment of it in his book. And then there was Richard Burke's original movie of the same name in Cold Blood. Did you see Infamous, by the way, with Toby Jones playing Capote?
I did not see that movie, no.
Terrific film. He actually, I think he played Capote in a much more reminiscent of the man himself than Philip Seymour Hoffman did. It's a very different performance. I recommend it.
I had wanted to see it, yeah, but it kind of got lost, I think. Both films came out around the same time, right?
You're right, yeah, and of course there was all the Oscar chatter for Hoffman's work, which he deserved, and poor Toby Jones got lost in the road dust.
Yeah, that's too bad. I had heard good things. So I would like to ask you about Perry Smith and Richard Hickok. What were they like? And was there anything in their past that might have revealed a penchant for this type of violence?
Well, in Perry's case, he came from a sadly broken home. His mother was not Cherokee, as Truman Capote had indicated, but she was a mix of Northern Paiute and Shoshone. And his father was Caucasian, but both Flo and Tex, as they were known, were performers on the rodeo circuit. They often had, at home, alcohol-fueled fights, which left the three children to fend for themselves. His brother and his wife committed suicide, and one other sister of Perry's, one he cared a great deal for, died as well. And so he was stricken with grief as a child. From all appearances, he was a quiet child too, preferring to write about his feelings or draw pictures, but having also later very strong opinions about people and life situations. He was largely self-educated and on the real sensitive side, far from what you might expect of a mass murderer. Richard Hickok, on the other hand, grew up under slightly more privileged circumstances, with a loving family, a mother and father who just adored him. He was a very popular athlete in high school, achieved high grades, a real smart guy who unfortunately had psychopathic impulses. He was clearly the alpha of the two between he and Perry Smith, and he led Perry down a dark path that would end in ruin for both of them. As far as a penchant for violence, you asked, Hickok did have a nasty car accident that may have caused him some form of head injury. It was never diagnosed at the time, but looking back, it was very probable he suffered from traumatic brain injury, since his own family reported that he'd changed for the worse after the accident, becoming generally meaner and more self-centered and less caring about other people. By the way, shortly after receiving Harold Nye's materials, another client came to me, I should mention this, in a completely serendipitous way, offering me another lot to auction, this one containing Perry Smith's personal journals, which included family photographs, letters to and from various people, among them Garden City Undersheriff Wendell Meyer and his wife Josephine, who were the jailers of Smith and Hickok when they were captured in Garden City and during the murder trial. As if that material wasn't fascinating enough on its own, I couldn't believe my luck when I came into possession of Richard Hickok's personal letters, some 200 of them, that he had written to a writer named Starling Mac Nations. Nations and Hickok had agreed to write a book on Hickok's side of the story, since by this time Truman Capote had been interviewing both of them for his book, In Cold Blood, but spending far more time with Perry Smith, someone we believe he identified with more closely, since they both grew up in under similar circumstances, with darker family backgrounds.
Yeah. So if we do get a chance, I'd like to talk more about that in a bit. But one of the big questions surrounding this case is motive. Why the Clutters? Why Smith and Hickok? Why target someone so far away? And a lot of that revolved around a character named Floyd Wells, who played an important part in this narrative. What was his role in all of this? And do you believe it was diminished in Capote's book? did Floyd Wells really have the inside scoop on Clutter's financial situation?
Floyd Wells is the single most mysterious character in this entire story. And certainly the most interesting one from my perspective. He worked for Herb Clutter in late 1948 for about 7 months as a farmhand. He's, in fact, the one who told Richard Hickok while they were both at Kansas State Penitentiary, each for misdemeanors and larceny, things like that. Wells told Hickok about Clutter having $10,000 in his safe at home, which was the whole instigation of the robbery and the murders, which all started with Floyd Wells, who really mostly got lost in the shuffle during the trial. There wasn't much thrust given to Wells when, in fact, he was really the one who started it all. Probably should have been arrested as an accessory. Capote only dedicated two paragraphs to Wells in In Cold Blood, but Wells seems to have played a much larger role, something I was to learn by reading both Hickok's letters to Machinations and Harold Nye's investigation reports. First of all, Wells was just one of 20 or so employees Herb Clutter had, and he wasn't there for that long, just the 7 months. During court testimony, he claims he had a close relationship with the family, but that doesn't track with what other farm employees have reported, most of whom don't recall him at all. Or if they did, he was just there doing minor things on the farm. I think it would be stretching the bounds of credibility for Clutter to be telling an itinerant farm worker like Wells that he kept as much as $10,000 in cash on hand to pay people, as Wells has reported. And Clutter really never dealt in cash, just bank checks. He would even write checks for a dollar, for that matter. Wells's story, the whole story, never made any sense, not to me. I think he made up most of it for reasons I lay out in the book, but probably we shouldn't reveal here.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for 4 furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
So let's talk about Nye's files and some of the surprises in those files. Surprises that made you question the generally accepted Capote narrative.
Well, first of all, getting back to Floyd Wells for a moment, Hickok claims he got a diagram of the clutter house from Wells, showing where each room was and who slept where and a map on how to get there. A diagram, by the way, which was never recovered as evidence. It was never found. It just disappeared. But Wells, for the short time he was there, he was never inside the new house. It hadn't been built by that time, by the time he left the Clutter's employ in the late 1948. Whether Capote knew this or not is unknown. I'm not sure whether he did or not. I can't find any notes in his materials that talks much about Wells at all. But it is a crucial point of evidence that just everyone seems to have missed. Now, next, as to the among the investigation reports, I discovered that a night marshal in the nearby town of Cimarron had reported three suspicious young men, two of them fitting the description of Smith and Hickok to a T, in a diner called the Western Cafe. Now, this was at 3 a.m, just an hour after the murders in Garden City, which was some 25 miles away. And no one had discovered the bodies yet, so this town marshal, night marshal, in the cafe, seeing these guys, had no idea that there was a murder had taken place. We don't know who that third person was, but in Hickok's letters, he mentions that they were going to meet up after the murders with someone named Roberts. Hickok writes that as they were murdering the Clutters, they had an hour to meet this Roberts. They didn't want to miss that because $5,000 is a lot of money. And that's what the point of the meeting was to collect $5,000, the other half of a prepayment of $5,000 for the job. That's what led me to believe this wasn't a simple robbery, but actually a murder for hire. Now, this Roberts character was impossible to find. I spent months trying to find him, Eric. I looked high and low, every possible document I could get my hands on. Now, the KBI did a pretty good search of all nearby motels in their investigation, and they did find two men named Roberts on two separate motel guest registers, both of whom checked out the day before the murders. That may be coincidence, but I find it rather interesting. Otherwise, I couldn't get a lead on this guy if he ever did exist.
Yeah, that's part of what makes this whole case so intriguing. As you write in your book, that the KBI's current narrative regarding the Clutter case investigation, which they consider a major victory, and it's touted by them as a big example of how competent they are as an organization.
Sure.
But the narrative is based completely on the Capote book, and they've forgotten a lot of the details about their initial investigation.
So to this day, the KBI still refers to In Cold Blood as the official story.
Which contradicts a lot of what Harold Nye said, yep. And he was the man who did a lot of the grunt work on this case.
I can see why the state didn't want this material to come out in public, because it would denigrate the ladder on which they all strive to achieve based on In Cold Blood.
Yeah, very interesting. So you mention a third possible person, a large payment. That supposed payment, it was never discovered in the possession of these guys, right?
That's right. Another curiosity If Hickok got that money, there's no record showing where he might have spent it. His father even asked him, and this is part of the letters that Hickok had written. There's one page remaining, one original page from that's in the Kansas Historical Society's records, and in that is his father, Hickok's father, coming up to him in his cell, saying, "Three men outside just asked me if you got paid for doing this," and to which Hickok denied. But for three different men, and presumably those are law enforcement officials because they're in the jail, I don't think they'd allow reporters in there, to ask him if he got paid for it. But there was reason that they asked the question.
So that's probably the question that all of my listeners are asking themselves right now.
Yeah.
Who would pay that kind of money to bump off Herb Clutter?
Without going into details that I outline in the book, it's just far too much to do in this venue. I do allude to some reasons why. One might be have interests in high government. I find that an appealing approach. But at this point, it's so hard to say. I'm even reluctant to generalize on it, given what I've been through with the state's legal system.
And another possibility is that it might have had something to do with an affair that Herb Clutter was having with the wife of his business partner, although that's pure speculation.
Well, it's not so much speculation as witness reports. There were witnesses that did identify Herb and the wife of his business partner at the time, that and they were found dancing without each of their spouses at a co-op dance, one of the farmers' co-ops in Wichita, and there were a couple other incidents where Herb Clutter was believed to have been with this woman. And now keep in mind, his wife was incapacitated. He was a vibrant, young, fit man in his mid-40s that had the world in his palm. And he could have had anything, really.
One of the great injustices in Cold Blood is the attention that Capote places on L. Dewey and not Harold Nye, as we've already established.
Right.
But what was L. Dewey's role in all of this? Could you tell us?
Sure. Dewey was a seasoned FBI agent by the time he joined the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. So he'd been a lawman all his life as well. But he was actually the case coordinator for the Clutter investigation. He wasn't the lead investigator, as many people attributed, especially Truman Capote. He tended the office. He took in the field reports from the investigators. He managed the calls that came in. But the field investigation team itself was led by Harold Nye and three other investigators under him. For his efforts, Harold Nye was 9 months later promoted to the assistant director of the KBI. So that was, you know, pretty telling. But Dewey coordinated other local agencies as well as the attending all the investigation reports. Capote did have a very close relationship with Dewey and his wife, Marie. And as he needed a hero for his book, a protagonist of sorts, Dewey turned out to fit the bill with his, as Harper Lee often spoke, his movie star looks. Now, Harold Nye did the real legwork on the case, as many others at the time had noted, including, as I said, the head of the KBI at the time.
Interesting. So, again, even just watching the Capote movie last night, one thing that really struck me as being really odd is how easily Capote was able to get such prison access to Smith and Hickok. It seemed a little far-fetched in the movie.
It's actually quite accurate. It was $10,000. That's all it took.
Yeah.
Capote had actually made arrangements to pay that money through his law firm to gain access to Smith and Hickok. The warden had prohibited all press and media from being able to obtain interviews with Hickok and Smith, which was the number one ticket in town as far as the press was concerned. And Capote was furious that he couldn't get in because he had, of course, a book under contract he had to write. So he made arrangements through his well-heeled colleagues, his law firm, and comprised a former high-level politician and a senator, I believe it was, and others who could move mountains. And that ultimately got to the warden of the Kansas State Penitentiary, who allowed Capote in as often as you wanted. Actually, it was actually as shown in that movie.
Wow. So you mentioned Starling machinations and his own pursuit of information, and he seemed to become as close almost to Hickok as Capote was to Smith. And he actually finished a full manuscript. Would you share why we're not able to read that now?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Machinations and Hickok had decided to write a book on Hickok's side of things. Because Nations couldn't get access to Hickok in prison, they had to correspond by mail. So Hickok wrote, it must have been reams of paper. Hickok's own words were he'd written over 100,000 words. Unfortunately, only some 200 pages have survived that time that have been found. But they contain some pretty remarkable assertions, some of which I'd covered earlier, more of which are in the book. Now, Nations apparently did have a full book finished and ready for publication. It was called High Road to Hell. But publishers had turned him down. He actually went to Random House, who published In Cold Blood, or was publishing at that time. And they did not want another story to compete with Capote's. So they turned him down. And once Random House turned him down, he couldn't find another publisher interested at all. But the curious thing is, Nations was driving home on Christmas Eve of 1968, and had a one-car accident on a two-car lane, and was killed instantly. The next day, his bound manuscript, which others had seen sitting on his desk at the office, simply vanished, and it has since never been found. And his son Michael is still looking for it to this day.
Huh.
Yeah. Love to get my hands on that.
Yeah. Some of the revelations you make about Hickok, you lay out your evidence that he was a sociopath, but he was also violent, really violent. And you write in your book about how heartbroken he was when Percy Smith killed Herb Clutter before he got a chance to.
Yeah.
And Hickok almost burst into tears.
Yeah, poor Hickok very upset that Perry had killed everyone and didn't leave him the opportunity to kill someone himself. This is going to be a little macabre, so some listeners may want to tune out at this point. But Perry did hand Dick Hickok the knife after he had slit Mr. Clutter's throat, and urged him to stick it in the throat to make sure. Well, certainly Clutter was dead at this point, but so Hickok had jammed the knife repeatedly into the throat with some viciousness, I'm led to understand, that had no purpose, served no sense other than to appease Hickok's need to do something It's really, really dark stuff. Yeah.
So there is no question in your mind that, Smith and Hickok killed the Clutters. But the larger question is, were there others behind it and who they might have been?
Smith and Hickok were certainly the killers, definitely. In fact, Smith has admitted to pulling the trigger on all four, as I mentioned, despite his earlier claim that Hickok has shot two of the women. As to who might be behind it, I still can't. I can't really surmise. It could be someone who didn't want Clutter to be talking about the relationship he was having. It could be people related to the government and some policy issues that Clutter was responsible for that were not in favor with the Ezra Taft Benson, who was the Secretary of Agriculture at the time. Much more that we can go into here, but the book goes into, I think, deep details on both.
One of the things I really enjoyed your book is that you go back and forth. You talk about your legal battle with the KBI, and then you talk about the Clutter case. The book is not just about the Clutter murders, but your extraordinary efforts to keep control of these files. But one of the really sad things about this is that it took a really terrible toll on Harold Nye's wife, Joyce, right?
Yeah, Joyce was... It lived in fear of the KBI. She was convinced this may have been based on other situations she had seen when she talked to the other wives. I'm not really sure. I don't recall Ron going into great detail about it, except that she never trusted the KBI, anyone there. And she was always afraid that they were going to come break down the door for all the files that Harold legally was entitled to keep in his home, files, the cases that he had worked on. And by statutes at the time, anyone who worked on the case could keep file copies if they were called for future testimony and trial. So, yeah, Joyce was a mess about the KBI. Sadly, she died before learning that we prevailed in court. One of the things that really rubs Ron in the wrong way now. I'm sad for that.
I did want to ask you about some of the difficulties you had getting research materials, and especially getting a hold of a copy of the trial transcript. Can you tell that story?
That elusive transcript was one of the hardest things to come by. It remains a mystery today, Eric. You'd think that as a public record, and a prominent one at that, that it would be available to the public in the court records, but no. We tried and tried by phone calls, by email, by personal letter. Apparently, the court stenographer was a memorabilia collector herself, had taken it, and ended up selling copies at $600 each. And by the time we did find where it was and who had it and what the terms were, it was so far in the writing process that I didn't need it at that point. I had found an appellate court transcript that had everything from the earlier trial that I needed for my research. So that was, but you know, you run into these roadblocks all the time while trying to do your research in this, and pretty soon a suspicious pattern forms, and that was part of it.
You write in your book that the legal expenses were pretty astronomical.
Ours were in the six figures.
But so gratifying to come out on top at the end, right?
Yeah. Fortunately, our attorneys worked on a contingency, and we didn't get anything out of the trial. We did get $160,000 in attorney's fees from the state that paid for some of the attorney's costs. But that was just a wild ride and not a good one. not something either Ron or I would want her to do again.
Right. I'd like it if you could tell us more about your website and this exclusive bonus called the Evidence Room for listeners who buy your book.
Yeah, I put together a few choice items from the investigation files, from Perry Smith's journals, from Richard Hickok's letters, and posted them on a private page on the website for exclusive access as a bonus to readers of our book. And the Evidence Room has been quite popular, in fact, giving fans of In Cold Blood and our own book a glimpse inside a world-famous murder case, something they might not normally find on the Internet.
You have a personal website as well, correct?
They're combined now. I have all my books. I'm on GaryMcAvoy.com. You can also go to AndEveryWordIsTrue.com. It redirects there. But I've just finished publishing a book called The Magdalene Deception. This is my first hand at fiction. And it's a thriller set in the Vatican, which enjoys a few themes like the Da Vinci Code does. But all of my books are now on my own website, so you'll find the Evidence Room on the top menu there as well.
So what is your favorite item, either from your own personal collection or a piece of memorabilia that has passed through your hands?
Right behind me in my office here, it hangs on the wall, the first page of In Cold Blood, typed by Truman Capote and signed at the bottom by him. And I have it framed in a beautiful motif with a great picture of him. And next to that is Walt Whitman, who had written Leaves of Grass. It's framed with the first edition of Leaves of Grass. And there's a little note to him, or from him, to a couple of ladies who had ordered his book just as it came out in publication. Looking at my home is like being in a museum. I've got things everywhere.
So there have been three films based off of the In Cold Blood book. What did you think about the one from the 60s? Robert Blake was in that one, right?
Nothing beats the classic. No, that was the finest of them all. They filmed that in the courthouse where the trial took place, using some of the actual jurors from the original trial. They filmed it in various places, used the post office, and all. They used the actual furniture in the trial Richard Brooks did a truly historic touch on that film, and kept as close to the documentation as possible. Unfortunately, some of that documentation included Truman Capote's book, which didn't have much of the reality discovered yet. In fact, I'm not even sure Capote knew a great deal of what I've discovered, because many of the investigation reports weren't available to him, although he did get many from Alvin Dewey, we know that.
Huh. So have you been to the Clutter home?
I have not, no, and I don't have any interest in doing so, really.
Does the house still stand?
The house does still stand. It was sold just recently, as I recall. Somebody had mentioned it to me. I keep getting fans sending me little clips here and there of what's happening in Garden City and to the Clutter House. And a lot of people who've actually been to the Clutter House tell me their feelings about being there.
I find it so interesting that you fell into the true crime genre. Not your interest by a long shot. And now suddenly you are one of our national experts on this case.
Isn't that crazy? I've become the de facto expert on the Clutter case without setting out to be. And only because I spent 7 years researching it. All of my work, my writing, I don't cut corners. I only find what what is what can be verified, and I put out what's true. And I rarely make assessments on my own unless I can support them. I don't like being caught in lies. I learned that when I was a kid in Catholic school. So I can't lie. It doesn't work for me. I forget what I said. So working with the truth has always been a better course.
I wholeheartedly agree. Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
Again, I have been speaking to Gary McAvoy. His book is called And Every Word Is True. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.